The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
There's not really much of an excuse for legal practitioners to say, how could I have known this stuff? You know, because the body that licenses you has told you this for a number of years, and there's an abundance of resources online and as part of CPD training to enable lawyers to skill up or at least know where to go to acquire the relevant knowledge to protect their clients' interests.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Hearing. I'm your host, Becky Annison, and today we'll be talking about something very close to my heart, and that is climate. Climate risk is already an incredibly expensive business. Bloomberg estimates it is costing the global economy around $1.4 trillion a year, and businesses all over the world are paying for that cost. Now, as lawyers, we are well used to the language of risk, much more so than the language of climate, and today I'll be exploring what that climate risk looks like when it hits legal practice areas and how much of it falls within the lawyer's duty to their client.
The Hearing.
My name is Navraj Singhali, and I'm the Senior Lecturer in Climate Law at the University of Edinburgh.
Thank you very much for coming to talk to me today about something that I'm particularly interested in, and that is climate risk and what this means for companies. And so I was just going to kick off by asking you my big question, which is, we live in a world of climate risk. How do you see that affecting corporations?
So climate risks, the most obvious ones that I think most people would think of would be flood events or sea level rises or extended high temperature periods. And you can see how those would be particularly interesting or particularly concerning, rather, to corporations, because each of those could cause, let's say, damage to assets, or if you're kicking off a project, they could cause a spike in your project costs. If you've got an ongoing transnational complex business, your supply chains might well be disrupted. So these would be of interest, of course, to businesses, but also to investors, to insurers, and ultimately to shareholders. Those risks that I've mentioned, they're normally called physical risks. You know, obviously, they're the first stage risks arising from climate change. So that's sort of conventional idea of what climate change does. There's another category of risks, which is perhaps less intuitive, but no less important. And these are called transitional risks. So this is the idea that when governments or regulators take steps to address climate change, such as, let's say, reporting obligations for companies, or changes to, let's say, building code, that compliance with those new obligations will in themselves create a second set of financial risks or challenges to companies, which they then have to be aware of and comply with. So that's a second set. And I think a third set would be something that any lawyer would be very familiar with, which is liability risks. So liabilities arising from a failure to respond adequately or properly to climate change. So I think in three big buckets, those would address the basic forms of climate risk.
No, I think that's a really good summary. And it's going to help us as we move into my next question, which is that we hear a lot about climate risk. In some ways, it seems obvious or intuitive. If your warehouse gets flooded out, there's going to be some costs involved. Mm-hmm. And I want to know if you have a sense of how much this is costing companies and why we aren't actually specifically talking about those costs very often. And I'll explain what I mean by that. When I talk to companies in my climate-facing job, I will often say to them, do you know how much climate risk cost your business this year? And the answer is always, I don't know.
Yes, so that was pretty much going to be my answer. Because if the companies at the sharp end aren't able to quantify their losses, it would be almost impossible, actually, for anybody else to quantify them with any accuracy. So when losses are talked about here, they're always in vast, vast numbers, running into the many hundreds of billions, possibly more. And how that is, and you know, you can be an order of magnitude out and still be within the ballpark. So those obviously aren't particularly helpful numbers. The starting point, I think, is where you were, which is that these aren't always being fully accounted for. Obviously, the sector which is most alive to these issues is the insurance industry. Insurance, and it's something actually that, to its great credit, the insurance industry has been alive to for a very long time. This, to some extent, the idea of climate risk really came into the general commercial legal discourse in, say, you know, after about 2016, 2017, when the Task Force for Climate-Related Disclosure came into being, led by Mark Carney, then Governor of the Bank of England, now the Canadian Premier. And that really kicked off a process, a high-level financial services-driven process, where these issues were really starting to be thought about. But the insurance industry was thinking about this in detail at least a decade earlier. So there has been a lot of deep thinking on this. It clearly hasn't been bottomed out. It's clear that balance sheets, for example, corporate balance sheets aren't always reporting on these issues fully. Partly that's because it's only been relatively recently that there has been an obligation in company law for reporting, and of course that obligation varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction in whether it exists or not, or the degree of intensity of reporting and accuracy and so on. So putting numbers on these things, I think at this stage is very difficult, but you know, we're well into the 10 and 11 figures range.
I'm curious, and I'm going to go off a little off-piste here, but you and I have spoken about this before, about why companies aren't more interested in digging into these figures, because I feel, and it has to be a feeling because we don't have the data, I feel it's highly likely that these could be some very significant costs, costs that perhaps shareholders would be interested in understanding and seeing what the company's strategy is for reducing those sorts of costs. And so I wondered if you had any views about why we're not having a bigger discourse and a bigger discussion and asking some much harder questions around saying, is there a duty here if you have, as a company, all of your warehouses in a wildfire area for which you can no longer get insurance? Why are we not having deeper discussions about the risks associated with that to the market as well as just to the corporation?
Right. So I think there are at least four, maybe five different elements to any answer to that.
Amazing. So, I'm so sorry I've thrown that at you.
I'm pretty confident that by the time I get to the end of number two, I'll have forgotten three, four, five and six. But anyway, let's give it a go. So one answer would be that, and it's commonly said that if you can't measure something, you can't regulate it. I think the flip side is also true. If you don't regulate something, there's no incentive to measure it. Mm. And in jurisdictions where there is either no regulation on climate risks or where the regulation is very broad, corporations will inevitably not have paid a great deal of attention to this issue. Mm. The second issue, answer to your question, is that it's sometimes very difficult to disentangle the causes of an extreme weather event. Mm. Or rather, it's almost always very difficult to disentangle those issues. Not so much the question of, is there an increased frequency of extreme weather events in this geographical locale as a consequence of climate change? That we can talk about, scientists can talk about with some degree of accuracy. The question of whether this wildfire was caused by climate change is extremely difficult to determine. So that causal link between climate change, climate risk, and a climate impact isn't always straightforward. Probably easier in a place where you have extreme weather events of the sort that you didn't used to have 30 years ago, and now you have extreme, once in a century extreme weather events every year. In that case, it's slightly easier. So that's the second element. A third element would be termism. So these are often medium to long-term horizons on which we are attempting to scan. Are we building this multi-billion pound dollar infrastructure that's going to last for 30 years? Are we building it in the right place? Now, we might take that decision on the basis of current costs or costs over the life of the duration of the build out of that infrastructure, but not necessarily over the factor in the 40-year risk that of climate risk. And so the calculation basis may not be fully aligned. It could also, and built into that, notoriously, companies operate from quarter to quarter.
Yes.
So if corporate decision making is taking on the basis of quarterly time periods rather than decadal risks, then you can see that the two things aren't properly aligned. And I hesitate to just come up with my shopping list here, but a final one really goes to the issue of shareholders. And you mentioned this specifically. Shareholders, according to the theory, will be extremely concerned about climate risk. They want to ensure that the financial assets that they put their pension savings into are not suddenly stranded because the power station or the other sort of infrastructure is flooded or burns down and is therefore valueless. So this is sometimes called, economists sometimes call this the efficient market hypothesis. And it's the idea that markets work smoothly and that shareholders will invest where the risk return profile is optimal and so on. This makes particular assumptions about how shareholders and other investors operate. And a lot of the research that has come out in the last 5-8 years suggests that actually shareholders work on much shorter timelines than that, not even quarter to quarter, but much, much shorter than that. So, and that includes fund managers. So fund managers will often work on much shorter horizons. And if that's the case, then these longer term risks don't necessarily vest with them in the way that you might expect, taking that sort of idealized economic theory.
Well, that's very interesting, actually. Well, all of this has been a preamble, I suppose, to my big question, which is that this is The Hearing, this is a legal podcast. And so the big question, of course, is, and what sort of duties do you think lawyers have to advise on those risks? And I'm particularly interested in which practice areas you think are most affected.
So here in the UK, we have a pretty good steer on this from the regulator, which is the Law Society. So the Law Society of England and Wales in particular has really taken a very firm lead on this. As early as 2003, they produced a guidance document called The Impact of Climate Change on Solicitors. And that set out, you know, really quite clearly and in a good deal of detail also, the sorts of practice areas that might be implicated by climate change. Spoiler alert, more or less they said all of them. The sorts of professional obligations that of solicitors that might be engaged by climate change, and how solicitors, when giving advice to clients, might have to think about climate change. And so we've got some pretty detailed guidance on that. And I can share with listeners some of the guidance that has been developed. So in terms of the practice areas that have been highlighted by the Law Society, it's actually a pretty comprehensive list. So they talked about things like corporate governance, corporate reporting and due diligence, disputes, construction disputes, real estate, commercial contracts, as well as the other stuff, which I think gets a lot more airtime, things like human rights and administrative review. But in particular, in the areas such as real estate, I think that's a really important one. And actually, just earlier this year, I think in June or July, the Law Society produced a more detailed note on property transactions and conveyancing specifically, and how solicitors who work in those areas would need to think about climate change when giving advice. So ultimately, you know, the sort of basic way to think about this is in terms of the duty of care that solicitors and indeed all legal professionals will have to when giving advice. And the common law position has been something around the lines of that reasonably competent practitioners should have regards to the standards that are normally adopted in their profession. That's been repeated in the statutory framework for the provision of services in England and Wales. The guidance goes somewhat beyond that, puts a little bit of the Law Society's guidance, puts a little bit of flesh on those bones along the lines that and I'm quoting here, that solicitors may have to look beyond the narrow scope of an instruction by a client to consider whether and to what extent climate risks are relevant. So it's not just a question of taking instruction and thinking about this in a straightforwardly traditional, let's say, commercial sense. That idea of what commercial is now has to incorporate the idea of climate risks. So for the purposes of a solicitor advising on a property transaction, they would have to think about those three categories of risks that I mentioned right at the top of the podcast. So physical risks, transition risks, and liability risks, and have to think about those in the context of the advice they give to the client prior to purchase, what are the implications, and in particular the lending implications of that advice, and also the insurance implications of that. So the insurance implications are actually at least twofold. The insurance implications could be the physical insurance risk, but also the professional indemnity insurance of a practitioner. This field actually is awash with writing on both of those issues. But in particular, for the purposes of solicitors, what the implications of these sorts of risks are for their premiums, for their professional indemnity premiums, as well as the risk of professional negligence claims. And going back to that property transaction example, it might, for example, be a prudent or within the ambit of reasonable competence for a conveyancing solicitor, for example, to use a climate risk search tool. So that a search tool that will geographically identify what is or isn't a risky property, taking into account flood risk or extreme weather events and so on. So a conveyancing solicitor who didn't avail themselves of such tools might well be deemed to be falling out with the guidance and therefore out with the standard of a reasonably competent practitioner. So just to give an example of everyday legal practice for a lot of legal practitioners, that would be an example.
No, and I'm really pleased you did that, actually, because obviously, I've been working in this field for nearly 5 years now, but the more examples that I come across of climate risk, which does actually naturally sit inside a practice area and which you might actually expect a lawyer to advise on, I think when you dig into it, the Law Society guidance, I think, is correct. I think it is wide. And previously, as lawyers, perhaps we've thought, well, that's the environmental team's job. But some examples from my own practice. I remember many, many years ago when I was a practicing in-house solicitor, and this well before COVID, when the first swine flu concerns were being voiced. And suddenly I remember getting an absolute influx of instructions about putting pandemic clauses in the commercial contracts that we were doing for facilities management, you know, and they would range. But, you know, some of the more extreme ones would say in the event, well, they would try and say, and I would always strike them out, but they would say in the event of a pandemic situation, if X percent of your workforce go off sick, you will redirect staff from other jobs to prioritise our contract. And obviously, you know, nobody in their right mind would want to sign up to that sort of stipulation. But those were the sort of clauses that I was seeing coming through in a completely different area, pandemics rather than climate change. But I always, when I got into climate change work, I always started thinking, well, if it is within a lawyer's remit to draft a clause dealing with a potential risk like a pandemic, before COVID even, surely it is within a lawyer's remit to say, you will make sure that none of our stock is housed in warehouses in flood zones. Mm-hmm. And that's, and so it seemed like a really natural transition for me at that point. And so the idea that it is not in every area of practice for a risk which saturates every area of life seems odd.
I think that's absolutely right. And you've given that example. I gave the example of conveyancing. Possibly one of the best founded practice areas would now be company law and company lawyers and the statutory obligations, disclosure obligations, which are now imposed upon lawyers under the companies in the UK, under the Companies Act. I know there's a parallel regime in Australia that's very well embedded also in the US under the SEC rules, although that's perhaps in a particular position right now, and other people are better placed to discuss that than I am. But the obligations on corporates, generally larger corporates, at least 500 employees or more, and over a particular revenue threshold, to financially disclose their climate-related risks, is now a very well-developed practice area, which entails companies reporting on their governance in response to climate risks, what their strategy is to mitigate those risks, how they think about risk management, their targets and metrics for dealing with all of these issues. So this is, as you say, this is not an environmental issue anymore. In fact, as a climate lawyer, I have never really seen myself as an environmental lawyer. I think environmental law is really something quite distinct from what I regard my work to be. So I work on issues such as, my substantive work is on issues such as carbon capture and storage and the network code, which is essentially contract law, or greenwash, which is a matter of consumer law, or other issues. But, you know, this is much, much wider than just, and I say just not in a disparaging sense, but just traditional environmental law, which is concerned with air, water, soil pollution. Mm.
I know that you and I have spoken in the past, and I have posited my pet theory, which now I get to share with the listenership, which is I am waiting for the first piece of case law that says that flood doesn't fall within the definition of your force majeure clause because it was not reasonably unforeseeable. It was utterly foreseeable given the trajectory of climate science. I think that we are not far away. If it hasn't already happened and I haven't noticed it, that's a possibility. But I don't think we're very far away from that ruling on a force majeure clause at all.
That raises an interesting question that listeners might have, or a concern they might have, which is that I'm only a lawyer. I'm not a climate scientist. How could you conceivably expect me to know that or be familiar with those sorts of risks? And I think the answer comes in two forms. One is that in the Law Society's guidance, it talks about the duty of care and a duty to warn and a duty to disclose, all of those sorts of regular duties that legal practitioners are familiar with. It also includes includes guidance on the specific issue of actions to take when there are gaps in your competence. Mm. And recognizing when there are gaps in your competence should be something that lawyers are able to identify, even if they aren't able to know exactly what it is that they need to do. And I think this goes to issues of understanding the broader risk profile, not necessarily the specific one, and then understanding how to address competence issues. So, and nowadays, of course, now that law societies and other regulatory bodies have been talking about these issues for a number of years, there's not really much of an excuse for legal practitioners to say, how could I have known this stuff? You know, because the body that licenses you has told you this for a number of years, and there's an abundance of resources online and as part of CPD training to enable lawyers to skill up or at least know where to go to acquire the relevant knowledge to protect their clients' interests. And I gave the example actually right up front about the climate risk tools that conveyancing solicitors can avail themselves of. So there is, of course, always going to be a gap between what legal professionals know and what climate scientists would advise. But that gap can readily be closed by a series of practices and mechanisms which are out there.
The Hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
As allegiances are tested.
You're gambling with World War III.
And regimes fall.
Fighters and civilians continue to stream in from other parts of Syria.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News podcast is there. We make sense of the news shaping our world and give you everything you need to know in a 10-minute podcast every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
So we've talked about the climate risks and we have talked about whether we think lawyers have a duty to advise on them. So perhaps my slightly provocative question that comes next is, are lawyers discharging those duties? And if not, why not?
It's a difficult one to answer, partly because what we don't have are reams and reams of cases, whether negligence cases or disciplinary cases, which would provide us with a very straightforward answer to this. My feeling is, and this is anecdotal, but in terms of the literature that we see from whether it's the case law or the statutory enactments or the legal professional literature, there is a lot of awareness of these issues. So for example, one of the niche areas I work on is the export credit agencies. Very few listeners, I imagine, will be up to their necks in export credit agency law as I am. And when I started working in this area, about 2018, 2019, the house journals of the global export credit agencies said absolutely nothing about climate change. Occasionally it said something about sustainability, but in the fluffiest possible sense. Nowadays, it's probably 50% of what they publish. You know, they talk of little else in those areas. So I think it would be difficult to say that practitioners are doing a particularly bad job in this area. I certainly wouldn't want to say that. My sense is that there's broad awareness of the issues, and that it's taken into account. Whether taking into account is a sufficiently strong standard, I think, is a separate question. Clearly, practices which I think most climate scientists would think are out with proper practice or within the limits of climate science, new oil and gas, other forms of carbon intensive activity, they're still going ahead. They're still being advised upon by clients, by lawyers who still take on those clients. So there's no doubt that these sorts of activities are going on. And if you took the view that, well, if solicitors are advising their clients properly, then those activities simply couldn't take place, then you would say no. But I don't think that's the right test. I don't think the test is, are high carbon activities still being financed and advised upon? What I think is the test is, are legal professionals flagging up foreseeable risks to clients?
Yeah.
And if they're not, I think the argument of failing to comply with proper professional duties could be raised. But I suspect that that's not actually what goes on, that the risks are being flagged and an assessment is taken by clients and by those providing finance as to what the risk reward calculus is. So I don't think that you could say that lawyers are failing in their duties as such.
I think you're right. For me, whether they're failing in their duties to discharge around climate risk isn't necessarily around working on oil and gas projects, although there's obviously a discussion to be had there. It's more about if you're advising on an M&A deal, which included a large amount of property, a huge property portfolio, are you asking the question about the flood risk of that? You know, if you are advising on buying a hotel chain in the Maldives, which somebody's expecting to make a return over on the next 20 years, are you advising on the likelihood of that hotel chain still being viable in 20 years' time? It's that sort of thing, I think.
I think that's probably right. And I can imagine that both clients and lawyers would, in the first instance, well, having had the issue raised, say, well, this sounds like a really important issue. What degree of certainty can you give me on the risk? And I think that that can be a challenge to provide.
Yes. But then I suppose that goes back to your earlier point. If you know you're not competent to provide that, then you would reach out to an environmental consultation team, you know, possibly a specialist environmental consultancy and get the advice from them, isn't it? As lawyers, we're not expected to know every single answer to every single thing, but certainly from my time as an in-house lawyer, you'd be expected to have a broad awareness of the sort of risks that might come up and who would need to come in and plug those gaps.
Yeah. And the answer very often won't be, there's a climate risk, I'm walking away. The answer will be, we accept there's a climate risk, how can we mitigate it?
Exactly.
So within that, there's a vast range of options available to corporates as to how they respond to risk.
So I think going a step further, or perhaps a step back for some lawyers, and saying this is something that's within your area of the expected area of expertise, according to the Law Society, and given that there is a gap in a lot of lawyers may have a gap in their knowledge in that area, what would you like to be putting on the curriculum for law degrees for the next generation of lawyers we're training up, who presumably are going to be hitting the real sharp end of this as their careers get going, because that's when these risks are really going to start manifesting even harder than they are now?
Sure. Maybe not most law schools, but many, many law schools have climate law programs, generally at the graduate level, in which these sorts of issues are dealt with in huge detail. That, however, is really the minority of practitioners. However, where it really makes a difference is where the climate input is in the qualifying law degree, so the LLB in the United Kingdom or the JD in the US. And there you can imagine that there just isn't a lot of space in the curriculum. You know, a property lawyer or a trusts lawyer will say, the curriculum is so tight as it is. I think the answer to that statement, which I think is perfectly fair, is to say there are ways to mainstream climate considerations in the curriculum. So, for example, I teach administrative law at the undergraduate level, and a lot of the cases that I now teach are climate cases. Several climate cases have reached the Supreme Court in the UK Supreme Court in the last few years on extremely important issues, both for climate change, but also for standard administrative law. If you want to understand how discretion operates in a public law context, there are ample examples from climate change type cases. And I understand that this is very much the case in certainly company law, which we've already discussed, and property law, which we've discussed. If you might think that criminal law is one of those areas which isn't really touched by this, but if you think of the rights of freedom of association and the right to protest, climate protesters are in the news constantly. The access to jury trials, something that in the UK at the time of recording is a very hot topic. This is driven in large part by a concern that climate protesters are getting off before juries. So, you know, there are relatively few practice areas or areas of legal education in which these sorts of issues couldn't be communicated, which is not to say that they would overtake the entire curriculum. You've got to teach what you've got to teach, but it can be taught in particular ways to raise awareness of these sorts of issues, so that when lawyers are coming to those sticky questions and trying to understand what they don't know, that they're not in a state of bafflement, they're proceeding from a degree of knowledge.
Fantastic. So we've already touched on this with the construction guidance from the Law Society. But there are going to be people listening to this who are not about to undertake a degree in law, but who are already practicing, thinking, jolly hell, I need to upskill on this right now. Have you got any recommended resources on where people could go to just get started outside of the construction content that the Law Society's put out?
Sure. So I think in general terms, there are some very good organisations out there that provide very clear guidance on the climate risk generally. So I think I mentioned some of these are public bodies as well. So the PRA in the United Kingdom, this is a committee of the Bank of England, provides very good guidance in this area. You could go to the TCFD, and I can provide links for all of these afterwards. I think one of the better ones is something called the STBI, so the Science-Based Targets Initiative, which provides very clear sectoral specific guidance on climate risk. So that I would really recommend. If we're thinking about guidance for lawyers, then I hope I don't make you blush here, Becky, but the Chancery Lane Project has a series of really excellent tools. I think they call them toolkits across a really wide range of practice areas that are, you know, possibly the best tools that are out there, in particular around clauses. So the very, very practical sorts of issues that most lawyers deal with most of the time of drafting clauses or negotiating clauses, there's a really broad range of climate-aware clauses which have been drafted by practitioners in conjunction with the Chancery Lane Project. And those are often clauses which practitioners have used in practice and they know they work. And so I think that's a particularly rich resource.
Thank you. You are the expert in this area. although I am a very passionately interested person in it. What is the question that you wish I had asked you that I didn't?
I think an interesting question, which listeners might have views on, is whether we have passed a golden age. So we often think of the golden age as some glorious period in the past that has slipped away. And at the end of 2025, I wonder if listeners might not think, well, a lot of these things you're talking about took place in an earlier age. The Law Society's guidance was in 2003. The Competition and Markets Authority had a green claim code in 2001. The Prudential Regulation Authority, its guidance on banks and insurers' approach to managing financial risks was 2019. And so this is all from a particular period that seems to be under pressure. And given that a lot of these are sort of soft law mechanisms or guidance rather than hard law, Companies Act apart, I suppose there could be a concern that this is something which may be under pressure going forwards. And I don't think it's wrong to think about those challenges, the risks to awareness of climate risk. I think the answer to that, though, is that rather than thinking of that as a nostalgia for something that's past, but all it is an obligation for us who are concerned about these issues and who are, as you say, passionate about these issues, to really take that challenge on and to grapple with it in a positive way and to view that period. I think you can bracket a period from about 2019 to 2023, and you can take that period as really the first wave of regulatory climate action, in particular for professionals and professional obligations that arose from those, and think about what the next wave will look like and how the next wave develops, sometimes in the teeth of very challenging circumstances. So I think that's what we should probably be thinking about as we move into 2026, and what I think will inevitably be a slightly more hostile environment.
Yes, that's a really interesting take on it, and quite a positive one, I think, as well, to end on. So thank you ever so much for coming and speaking with me today. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks very much. It was great.
Thank you.
I hope the listeners enjoy it too.
The Hearing.
I have long been of the opinion that climate risk falls squarely inside a lawyer's duty to advise because it is so pervasive, so relevant, and increasingly so costly. But it can be incredibly daunting staring down the scope of this ever-widening set of knowledge to master as a practice area expert. Of course, we still have work to do to prevent the worst of the climate crisis, but the effects of that crisis on businesses are already biting, and they are biting hard. The costs and risks associated with climate change are likely going to increase hugely over the coming years, and businesses will need a great deal of help and support to identify and manage those risks. Lawyers who can provide that help will be very valuable. Thank you to Navraj for speaking to me about this, and thank you for listening. And if you have any questions or comments on the episode, then please email us at thehearing@thomsonreuters.com. I've been Becky Anderson. Goodbye.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.